Welcome to another edition, another episode of Classics at Josie's Cafe, and with me here today is Paul.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Paul wanted us to do a Coen Brothers movie, and we were going to do No Country for Old Men, but you're like, no, if we're going to do a Coen Brothers movie, we're going to do Fargo.
Yep.
So, we're doing Fargo, which, yes, it's an amazing, classic Coen Brothers film. I mean, if it's not the quintessential Coen Brothers film, I don't know what is. But,
Big Lebowski would
be one of those. Big Lebowski. Yes. So, we'll just kind of jump right into it. For those who don't know, Frances McDormand, who plays the lead character, won an Oscar for this, and they also won an Oscar for the screenplay for this movie. So it's a kind of like a mystery type movie, but has a lot of comedic beats along the way, very dry comedy.
Dark comedy, dark especially.
Dark comedy, yes. So tell me a little bit about, like, I don't know, things that you think make this movie a classic.
Definitely, I feel like what stuck out to me the most was the disclaimer at the beginning.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, apparently the film is based on true events, and they stuck as close to those true events as they could, they said, which I thought was really interesting because of the situations in the movie. You know, very, very wacky, ridiculous situations. Other than that, I feel like the script, like, they're very good at having dialogue sound natural.
Yes.
Like, especially with, you know, these people being so close to Canada, they use, you know, they're one of the most memorable lines in there is like, oh yeah? Yeah.
right. Yeah, the dialect is really fun to watch. Yeah, yeah. For sure. Yeah, I mean, they do a really good job of capturing, I guess, the people there in the area, the coldness, the snow, which I hear during production was pretty difficult. They were actually having a warm winter, the warmest in 100 years. So recreating that was a pain. But other than that, I do agree that these were inspired by true events, but the characters are completely theirs. They're all Coen made characters. And obviously the cinematography, I mean, in this movie is one of the best Coen cinematographies. And I think this is made by a cinematographer that they've routinely used early on.
A lot of the shots were, they really did remind me of No Country for Old Men. Do you know if the cinematographer worked on that one also?
I'm not sure. I know that he has worked on several of the films. I forget what his name was. I guess we can look him up. But yeah, they do have a distinct style. The Coen brothers, at least for most of their movies. And I think that's the appeal when it comes to how they shoot their movies, because they don't just, they're not like other directors who kind of just cut and paste things together. These guys edit their own movies, and when it comes to especially dialogue and the scene that they're shooting, they're very similar to Alfred Hitchcock, where everything is intentional. And so you have to really pay attention to the directions, because what I mean, like, direct their view on things as directors, because everything that they're saying, every line that's being said is intentional. And that's a master director. In this case, two master directors who obviously have put a lot of thought into their characters, their story, and what they want to show you. But the cinematographer is Roger Deakins, and he's an English cinematographer, and he actually not only works with Coen Brothers, but he worked with Sam Mendes and Denis Villeneuve, which he was the one that did like the new Blade Runner. I don't know if he did that movie, but he did Beautiful Mind, Skyfall, Sicario. Yeah, he did do the new Blade Runner. Oh, that's crazy.
Oh, nice.
So this guy, oh yeah, he did. He also did No Country for Old Men. So, man, this guy's legit.
It's quite a resume.
Yeah, yeah. And he actually, oh wow, he actually worked on the series Fargo also. That's pretty cool.
I've been wanting to watch that. That's going to be my next show to pick up because they actually have it on Amazon Prime. So if you have Prime,
yeah,
you can watch it for free.
Nice.
Yeah.
I've seen the first two episodes. I mean, first two seasons. So.
And it also has, what's his name, Marty Friedman from, wait, Marty Friedman? No. Marty something from Sherlock. What else?
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, he was on the first season, I believe.
And The Office. He's in The Office.
Yeah. No, it's a great show. I think they did their own kind of take on this, on things, but overall, in regards to a lot of the comedic, dark comedic beats, I mean, they do a really, really great job. But now let's get to the movie. Like, for me, I'm right there with you. To me, it's a very heavy character driven type of movie.
Yeah.
Steve Buscemi. Like, this has to be, in my opinion, Reservoir Dogs and Fargo has to be his top movies. I mean, he really knocks it out of the park in this movie. I can't picture anybody else playing his part.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Especially when they tailor that one line to him, where he's like, they're asking about Steve Buscemi's character and what he looked like. He was like, well, he sort of looked a little funny.
And right.
Like, well, funny how? Like, well, in a general sort of way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, and they don't do it once. They do it like two times.
Yeah.
Twice. That's the thing about it. Oh, man, it's so great. I mean, even when the guy tells him, like, this guy's at a lake or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Even when he's saying their lines, he's saying what he says, you can, oh man, the way that it was made, I don't know how they did it. I don't know if they did the scene first and then they just filmed him telling the story.
Uh-huh.
Because that's the way I would have done it.
Yeah.
Because you would really got the inflection, I guess.
Yeah.
But the way he says, like, oh yeah, and then he said, you know, something about like, well, the last man that, something I killed him. He goes, oh well, that does that. Then I said, well, that was not too good for him.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, like, wow, that exchange, like,
yeah, you could see the scene play out in your head.
Yeah, that was so well done. Like, any other person would have just done the scene,
uh-huh,
and then this guy would have just called him on the phone, like, hey, this guy, whatever. But the way that they did it, he's telling the cop the story, and then just they end up looking at the sky like, oh, yeah, it looks like it's going to be cold or something. I was like, wow, this is just perfect. So perfect.
Yeah, seems very, very natural. Something right. you'd see, definitely a scene that would come out, you know, happen right in front of you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's the thing about the aspect of Fargo that I like. It's it is a kidnapping, mm-hmm, for ransom. And the first scene, well, actually, before I get into that, essentially the movie is a kind of like a crime movie, mm-hmm, basically, you know. It's, and I think they're ripping off the, mm-hmm, those, I mean, the thing that I'm thinking of is like those made-for-TV movies, Lifetime movies, like this is based on a true story. Like, they're ripping off that. It's like a inside joke, like, well, technically any movie made is not going to be the true story, you know. Yeah. There's going to be some sort of, I mean, you weren't there.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to say. You weren't there. So I think that's the inception, the idea of this movie, in my opinion, because it's like kind of like a true crime story, but they kind of figured, like, well, no one's going to know exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, well, this is how ridiculous things are, and they just kind of had fun with it.
Yeah,
you know, especially with the wood chipper scene, and oh my God. You know. But what I like about it is that all these things that they do in a regular, I guess, we'll call it like a regular suspenseful movie like this, like they would have just done like the I'm gonna kill you type thing and everything would have gone perfectly fine. Like the plot itself is just like they kidnap the girl, they sit on the cabin, shit goes wrong, he shoots down the father-in-law, mm-hmm. and buries the money. You know, anybody else would have taken that linear plot and that would have been it. But yeah. The subtleties that these guys use, you know, mm-hmm. her running away from the car like a chicken without a head, you know, and like tripping over herself in the very beginning on the stairs, like these clumsy little things, yeah. It's the nuances that they add in very humanizing way.
And that was like I said, you know, this movie feels so realistic, you know, like you feel like these events could have happened.
Could happen, yeah.
Exactly the way they did, especially when, you know, you mentioned where she falls down the stairs.
Right.
Like that scene right there, oh my God, I loved it. You know, like, what's his name? His name, Peter Stormare's
character. Oh, right. Bleach blonde hair.
Yeah. So like, you know, he's like trying to find antiseptic or
for his cut. He doesn't care about her at this point. He cares about like his wound.
Yeah. So you know, he's looking through a medicine cabinet, and then he notices someone inside of the shower, and then she pops out. Doesn't do anything to him because right. She's terrified.
Right. And he's in shock that this is happening.
What the hell is she doing? And she's got that shower curtain all over her, you know, blocking her view. And she runs out and then she falls down the stairs. That was hilarious.
Yeah.
That was fucking hilarious.
Like, exactly.
I could definitely see that happening in real life.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think that's what we always talk about noir movies, but mm-hmm. for me, noir kind of speaks about just the human condition and how mm-hmm. one person is not inherently good or inherently evil. They're a combination. They're having this inner battle. And it's like Joel and Ethan Coen take this premise and then really say, okay, but they're not as smart either.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we're kind of looking at each other in a mirror and just saying, look, you know, look how dumb we are. Look how naive we are, which goes to the main character. Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, that's really what I feel they're trying to say with, what's his name?
The husband?
Yeah.
Jerry?
Yeah, Jerry.
Yeah, yeah.
Played by, do you have his name?
William H. Macy.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're trying to say with him. He's like, he figures out a scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks he can pull it off. He thinks he's smart enough to pull it off, but he is so naive.
Yeah.
He is way out of his element.
Yep.
And so I just love that. I love how they pick up characters and they put them in places like fish out of water, but they don't know that they're fish out of water kind of thing. They still think they're smart enough to pull it off, but they're clearly not.
And I feel like a lot of that they show in that movie Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one definitely has a lot of that. But also, towards the end of Fargo, when, what's his name? Peter's character,
mm-hmm.
you know, he kills Steve Buscemi's character.
Right.
And, I don't know, it was just like I feel like Burn After Reading had a homage to Fargo,
because
at the end of Burn After Reading, what's his name? John Malkovich's character.
Mm-hmm.
He runs after that one guy and, you know, hits him with a hatchet.
And
it just reminded me of that.
Interesting. Yeah, I have to rewatch that now. It's kind of like a they're kind of
I guess I would say like they kind of had the same.
Yeah, it's similar
finale,
too. Yeah.
Very, very similar finales.
Because they're also, it's kind of the same idea. They have a bunch of different people that stumble onto something that's bigger than they are, and they're trying to capitalize on it, and it's just like, they're just not smart enough to really pull it off. Which I think that's, and I think this, I do have a whole point to make with this movie mm-hmm. that I totally missed before. Like, this is the first time that I actually paid attention to certain things. which I think lead into why these characters are delusional.
Yeah.
And I watched some reviews, too, to see if anybody else picked up on it. Nobody picked it up on it, so I just might be crazy. I might be the delusional one. But I guess we'll just start from the beginning.
Okay.
And I'll kind of, like, as we talk about it, I'll kind of throw these pointers up.
Uh-huh.
And we can see what your take is as well as we go. But in the very beginning, we'll just start with the opening shot.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about the opening shot at the end as well, because it all goes together. But we'll focus on Steve Buscemi. And, oh man, I wish I would have remembered the other guy.
Peter Stormare?
By the way, he is a phenomenal actor.
Yeah.
Like, everything he's in, the movie might just suck, but I just watch it because he's in there. Like, that guy's an amazing actor. Remember the VW commercials he used to do?
I don't.
Oh, dude. I'm going to just go to YouTube. They're just amazing. They're just insane. Anyways, so the setup, in my opinion, is one of the best setups in these classic movies. Mm-hmm. What it reminded me of, well, I'm kind of jump around the very beginning just so I don't forget.
Mm-hmm.
But the scene where they're in the bar and they're talking to Jerry about the heist.
Mm-hmm.
You just know everything's about to be a fiasco just by the way that things are going down.
Yeah.
You know, someone said 8:30, and, you know, Jerry says, oh, well, I thought it was 8:30. He goes, what are you talking about? It was 7:30. So there's a miscommunication. There's only supposed to be one person there, and there's two.
Yeah.
And, you know, this naive guy just says, well, let's just go ahead and just, you know, he doesn't care. He just wants to get it done. He's just so ready to just get it done. Just that disorganization itself should have rose so many red flags. So the way that they set it up is just perfect. Now, on the car ride there, I think it was right afterwards. It was in the morning.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how they're hungry, and he was like, you know, I think he says, I want to get some
pancakes.
Or he says, he doesn't say house of pancakes, he says pancake house.
Yeah, yeah.
So, which tells me there's something about the idea of going to pancake house.
Mm-hmm.
There's like this fantasy kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you don't want to go to just some pancake house. You don't want to just get breakfast at a diner. He wants to go to pancake house. Like, that's what he wants to do. So Steve Buscemi's like, all right, well, you know, we'll go get laid, and then we'll go to whatever. He's like, well, I'm hungry now, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it kind of shows a dynamic between them two,
uh-huh.
Shows a kind of bit of friction, but it also kind of you start to see how they see the world in mm-hmm. a way. And they pass Paul Bunyan.
Yeah.
Right? And that's foreshadowing to the ending, too. Yeah. Very interesting. So that's the beginning, but this is the interesting fact that I'm trying to get to. After they're done doing their raunchy sex or whatever, they both lay, almost like all of them lay like vegetables watching television.
Yeah.
And that was my first key, and I was like, okay, television, I'm going to make sure I write every single time that people watch television, and it's rampant throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
Like, everybody watches television. Frances McDormand's character watches television with her husband, but she's kind of not interested.
Yeah.
Which I think is an indication of something. But when the father-in-law is introduced,
mm-hmm.
he's watching the hockey game and he's so immersed in winning.
Yeah.
You know, he's just like, ah. So they're using the television to kind of show you these people and maybe what they really want or what they're all about.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's doing it. The wife that gets kidnapped, right before she gets kidnapped, she's knitting a sweater watching TV.
Yeah.
And it's like a Sunday morning type of thing. So this keeps going. The son watches TV. Even when she gets kidnapped, they're fighting with the TV because it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then getting a channel on the week with a beetle. Right before he kills Steve Buscemi,
mm-hmm.
he's watching a telenovela,
yeah.
And this woman is like pregnant,
yeah,
which is kind of interesting because the cop that's after him, well, she announces that she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, oh, that's interesting because Francis McDormand's character is pregnant and he's he's about to have a moment with him. Mm. So it's like all these things are happening. Like they're all kind of, in my opinion, delusional because of what the box is telling them or what they're, I don't know. Like, I think there's something there. And the only thing I could think of, it's like they're all kind of attached to this television and it's like their version of what the American dream is, right? And so this money, what this money represents to Steve Buscemi and the other accomplice is the idea that they're going to get this money and they're going to be happy and they're going to live the American dream, right? William H. Macy is doing the same thing with what he's doing. You know, is at what cost do you have to go to live up to this American dream? So, oh man, like, it's just thread throughout the whole movie. Mm-hmm. It's just very, very interesting. And you start to think about our society itself. Like, most people are glued to this television. They're letting this television tell them how to live their lives, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's true.
But yeah, I mean, that's one underlying thing that's going down there. The other thing we can jump off to is the scene where Jerry brings the idea about the parking lot to his father-in-law and then his, I guess, his Stan, the guy who, like, yeah, helping him.
I think it's like his father-in-law's best friend or something.
Right. Yeah. And then they're just like, the imagery to me, behind them and in front of them, well, behind them, I think there's like these horses and they're like hunting things. Mm-hmm. And then there's a picture of like a lions. And it just goes to show that this guy's just like all about just demolishing whatever, eating everything up, just you start to see these characters for what they are. Mm-hmm. And they talk about, I guess, the way that I thought about it was kind of like a idea of what corporate America is.
Yeah, like when I saw Jerry's wife, you know, his father-in-law, he gave off this very unique vibe of being like, you know, wanting to be in control all the time. I mean, and that's obvious from like his business and the way he dealt with Jerry with that parking lot situation. And like you said, you know, like the imagery in his office, you know, it's very, very elitist. Very, very elitist. And, you know, his office also is in like a, it looked like they're in like some downtown area and they're pretty high up as well. Because I saw, you know, some skyline, some buildings there. And this scene, I think, is one of the saddest scenes. But at the same time, like you said, Jerry is very naive. Very, very naive. And instead of going to a bank, asked for a loan, he went to his father-in-law. You know, these businessmen who he should have known from the start.
Yeah.
They're going to jump in on it. They have the money.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, well, we didn't talk about a finder's fee. And that's when I'm like, you notice all the statues and shit. You're like, man, these guys don't play.
Yeah.
And they're like, wait, finder's fee? He's like, well, you know, if you're not interested, we can just move forward with it. He's like, and they can say, oh, well, we're not in the bank. We're not in the bank. We're not a bank.
And my favorite part of that scene is when his dad's friend?
Stan? Yeah.
Yeah, where he's like confused about what Jerry wanted. And he's like, wait, Jerry, what was it that you wanted?
That was kind of awkward, right? Like, dude.
Because, like you say, you know, Jerry's naive. And he also thinks the same thing when he figures out that Jerry doesn't really understand what the situation is and how to go about, you know, building his own business and all that.
Right.
Like,
like, who do you think you are, man? This isn't Legos. So you can tell he's very just, man, he's so green, it's not even funny. So he's very head over heels. And these guys, I mean, this is what they do for a living. They're just sharks.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... I mean, they're, I guess they're showing, like, the corporate world and how it really works, how the big boys work, you know? But it's interesting because, to me, talking about, let's just talk about the parking lot itself. Because to me, I thought there's so much going on with the parking lot that a lot of people haven't really talked about. Well, at least the videos that I was trying to find, I saw a bunch of videos, and they're all reviewing, like, good versus evil stuff, like, very benign, like, very just basic stuff.
Very but, black and white.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's there, yes, I get it. But I think the Coens had more, they were trying to show more with the, there's more examples in there, in other words. So, right after that scene, they have that beautiful shot where he's walking to his car, and the shot just is just white, snow covered, the car's there. It's just like you could literally like just print that out. I'm sure people have printed it out, have it on their office or something. But it's like that defeated walk. He walks up there, and I mean that's cinematography at its best.
Yeah.
And he walks up there, and then he loses it on
his windshield.
On his windshield, yeah. And because he's, and that's another thing too, like the windshield's a metaphor for his cloudiness, right? Because he's just like, he's finally starting to see clearly a little bit as he's chipping away, and he's like losing it. And a lot of people like kind of, well, like me, when I first watched it, the performance, you gravitate to the performance. Oh my God, that's amazing. And yeah, that was a great moment. Laughable moment, because I think we've all been in that situation. We're just like, fuck, right?
Yeah.
But we're missing something there. We're missing the idea that he's slowly chipping away at this delusion that he has. And you kind of think, well, maybe there's hope that he'll snap out of it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he doesn't.
He doesn't at all.
Now, with the parking lot, because that was his thing. He was going to this parking lot, make him rich, and he was going to be set for life. Oh, and before I forget, there's that line where he's like, well, you know, this would be really good for Scotty, and what's her name, whatever. He goes,
yeah.
Scotty, and I never have to worry about anything. Doesn't include him. Fuck this guy.
Yeah.
But, that's kind of like ironic. Well, not ironic. It's just, it's interesting that this is happening at a parking lot. He's walking on this parking lot, and he has, I mean, this is his idea. And then after that, all these things start happening in parking lots. Steve Buscemi drives into a parking lot, and he's just there to change plates. And when he's going out, he has to pay $4 at a parking lot, right?
Yeah.
So to me, it's not like this. They're talking about this complete disdain for parking lots. Like, it's ridiculous you have to pay for parking.
Yeah.
And people are getting rich off of it. And so Steve Buscemi, you know, that scene where he's taking it out on the attendant, he's like, oh, what, you think you're a third figure here? You know what I mean?
Great line, by the way.
Yeah, great fucking line. Afterwards, at the end, we're like, you know, he's supposed to pick up the money. He has the same scene. Trying to leave the parking lot. He's like, oh, hey, do you have your ticket? And he kills the guy.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, yeah, fuck you. Kind of like just goes, breaks the little crossing thing. It's like we've all kind of been there like, God damn, I've been here like for 5 minutes. Why do I have to pay? And I think that's a sign, like a sign of frustration for just corporate America. People just figure out how to make money. I mean, to me, it's written there. Yeah, you know, helps move the plot over, but there's a statement said with Jerry trying to make a parking lot to make money. You know, he's deceitful. You know, he's a son of a bitch the way he's selling. They're trying to say, hey, this is fucking wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But yeah, I don't know. That's, I think that's why the parking scenes are all there and people don't realize, like, hey, this is all intertwined. It's such a great movie. So much stuff. Like, I'm even talking about, like, you know, the evil versus good aspects of it, because I'm just like, everyone gets that part, but I don't think they're missing the parking lot part right now. Now moving from that, I just wanted to reflect on some things. I mentioned Hitchcock in regards to Strangers on the Train. The shower scene with Psycho, I do believe it's intentional when Jerry comes home and he sees that they've ransacked his house.
Mm-hmm.
And then he stays staring at the curtain, and they're all plastic curtains. Like, it's a plastic curtain with, like, plastic rings.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a cool, like, I don't know if it's intentional or not. I have to think it is. But it's kind of like a little homage to, like, Hitchcock, you know, with Psycho, you know? Like, but back then it was, like, legit curtain, you know? It was, like, you know, there was a different type of product, I guess. And now they're kind of showing us, like, what we've degenerated to. It's like these cheap plastic bullshit. I don't know. That's just like my thought in scopes of the TV consumerism and, you know, these people living in fantasy La La Land and stuff.
I mean, I honestly can see that point because, you know, the whole plot of the movie is that, like you said, you know, it's achieving the American dream by getting money and committing a crime to get that money.
Right.
So, you know, I can see, you know, the little, how would you say, the little
nuggets, I guess.
Yeah, little nuggets of, I guess, their opinions on American consumerism and all that.
Yeah, it's like they're making, like, just comments on society.
Mm-hmm.
And what I heard was that the scene where Jerry is trying to sell the car to these customers, and their customers like, man, hey, you called me up, you told me you had a good deal and all this stuff, you lied to me, like that part. Supposedly that's all verbatim. Hmm. Supposedly that all happened to Ethan Coen.
Oh, wow.
And that the exchange was all like legit. Like, that's really what happened to him about the true coat and all this thing. And so, I mean, if that came from a... if that's true, then my theory proves to stand stronger. Because, you know, you go buy a car and it is like that. It's like, why am I paying for this? And why am I paying for that? And the part where, because I've done sales, so the part where he's like, well, go talk to your boss, you know, I'm not going to pay for that. And he goes, talks to his boss. He goes, hey, you think you might have a spare ticket? You know, just trying to make conversation casually, but he's not asking him anything about the sale. The guy's like, are you serious? Like, you're a moron? So, you know, he comes back and says, oh, well, great. I could bring it down $100. Like, $100? Like, I've been in those situations. And it's like, oh, man, they eat your soul away. Yeah. So, I mean, if that's true, then, and if this movie kind of started as complete distaste for just, you know, American consumerism, then I can see, like, okay, you have that part, and then you read some true story, you read the newspaper, and you're like, oh, this is interesting, wood chipper, huh? And you take that idea, and then you grab this other idea about a kidnapping, and before you know it, you have your own story, you make your characters, and, you know, you have a lot of things going on. You have a lot of things to say about society itself, but I think they go even deeper. I even started talking about Margie, Frances McDormand's character, which, oh, man.
She's an excellent detective, by the way.
She's amazing. She's just top-notch. I mean, I think that's another thing, too, is that when she first shows up, she gets that phone call, and you're thinking it's going to be the guy, because he's like a big, burly guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I'll make you eggs. And like, whoa, there's a role reversal here. And then the person who gets up to leave is her, and she's pregnant. And you're like, wait, 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 wait. So she's the one that's going to work the case? Like, I remember watching that when I was little.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, I must have been like 10 or something, and thinking like, man, this is messing with my head, because I'm so used to like watching Clint Eastwood movies, and
yeah,
it was like, no, like, she gets on the scene, and she that's the cool thing too, they showed us everything that happened, mm-hmm. and then she's like, oh, we got a runner, and the high speed chase, and this guy's a big fella.
Yeah.
So you kind of see, like, she's very perceptive right yes. from the get-go.
Yeah, especially when they go back to seeing where the state trooper was at.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she talks about it. She's like, well, yeah, it looks like, you know, the guy who moved him over here, he's smaller than his accomplice. You know?
Yeah.
Very, so very
smaller perceptive. Than his buddy. And then the other guy was talking about the plates, and he goes, no, 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 I think it's a dealer one.
Oh, yeah, DLR.
DLR. Oh. I don't think that's good police work there. I think she says something like that.
Yeah, she's like, I think you might have a mistake in your police work, something like that.
Yeah. So, and here's the interesting part. So, if you notice, her and her husband is like, they kind of have a process already established, sort of, mm-hmm. you know? They have some sort of order. And that's what you get to see is like, because he's kind of like just sweating about, you know, his work as an artist or whatever. And, mm-hmm. you know, she's making sure she goes to work. Like, they have their role set up.
Yeah.
And I'm sure stuff happens, but they're, you know, they're okay.
Yeah, they're happy.
And these other characters, they're just, it's just chaos.
Yeah.
So you're seeing, like, in a very simplistic way, just you're seeing chaos and order play yeah. out. And I mean, that's interesting, and that's another thing too, is that I think Margie's not really watching TV. In fact, she's just like kind of going to sleep,
mm-hmm.
right? So she's not really delusional.
Yeah.
And this is why I think this works, because of the character Mike that shows up, the one that mm-hmm. calls her out of mm-hmm. nowhere,
the Asian guy.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
because he's like, hey, how you been? I saw you on the television.
Yeah, that's right.
And then when they meet up, it turns out his story is all baloney. Yeah. You know, because he's all delusional.
Yeah.
And I'm serious. Like, this TV thing is something that they think that makes people delusional, I have to say. Do I need to say more? No. I'm going to try not to. I'm going to try to move past that. Talked about the parking lot thing, the TV thing. Let me see what else I got here. Yeah, because, I mean, people look for TV to fix their problems.
Mm-hmm. Just a very, very simple way for people to get distracted from what's going on in their lives.
Right. And I think also in a way it's like, and I think you could make a similar movie now. The only difference would be with cell phones
mm-hmm.
and internet. And the reason I thought about that is the scene with Steve Buscemi is with another girl, another call girl, and they're watching Feliciano play guitar.
Yeah.
And he's trying to have this true connection with this girl, and she's just not having it.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, well, what do you want? And then it just cuts to just them banging. And then you have Shep who comes in and just pretty much kicks his ass. But, you know, they're trying to find some sort of connection.
Yeah.
But I guess let's just get to the nitty-gritty.
All right.
Something that I noticed.
Uh-huh.
The briefcase that's brought to him and they're left with, and he buries, it looks exactly the same as the No Country for Old Men briefcase.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. It's black. Fold on top. It's a particular... Yeah, I noticed that.
Okay.
It's interesting, right?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, they like to put little Easter eggs of their other movies and, you know, and their more newer movies. Like I said, like, you know, that axe scene from Burn After Reading reminded me of the axe scene from Fargo.
Yeah, exactly. Now, with the axe scene in particular, it's interesting with the Paul Bunyan character and then this guy using the axe to kill him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
yeah, I feel like the Coen brothers definitely have a lot of axes in their movies. I mean, it's Fargo and Burn After Reading. I can't remember any in The Big Lebowski.
Right.
I don't remember any in No Country for Old Men.
Right.
You know, that one's more about guns.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they do have similarities because of, you know, Margie in the car with the killer, mm-hmm. and he's just like, God, I just don't understand this. Like, mm-hmm. she gets the killer, that's the main difference. But he's just like, man, I just don't understand why people are like this. They're just delusional or crazy.
Yeah, I honestly connected that with No Country for Old Men also, because Tommy Lee Jones makes a similar statement when he says, you know, this is No Country for Old Men.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, he's just like, you know, people will do anything to get what they want. It's crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, I mean, there's little things that they do, because, like, Paul Bunyan was in the very beginning, and then they cross Paul Bunyan at the very end. And I don't know if that's, like, foreshadowing to him killing his friend in that manner.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very, oh, yeah, I mean, I can connect that with television. Again, oh, these people are going to hate me. But, I mean, if he just passes Paul Bunyan and he sees this larger life character, then later on gives him the idea to kill this guy with an axe, I don't know. But it might be a subconscious thing, something you can't understand. I don't know. And then when he passes by Paul Bunyan again, he's like, oh, shit. Like, because he has that weird face, like, oh, man, like.
Yeah, he does. He does have a weird look about him towards the end. I think it might just be him, like, realizing that he's not getting out of this situation.
Yeah, like, this is it.
Yeah.
And that's also, like, kind of around the place where he first shot the state trooper.
Yeah, that's right.
So he's thinking, man, I'm back here. Like, oh, man, that's just, it's just interesting. I mean, the way that they just, I mean, just the thought of just doing that again, mm-hmm. just going past that place again is interesting.
And what I've been, like, what's been going through my mind, like, watching a lot of stuff lately, is, like, figuring out whether characters are written as sociopaths or psychopaths.
That's true, too.
Because, well, this is a little bit of a tangent. So I've been watching Shane Dawson's documentary on Jake Paul. You know who Jake Paul is?
Mm-mm.
Big YouTuber, used to be a Disney star, for a very brief Disney star, but he's known to just do these really crazy stunts and bully anyone on his, what they call, like, a team. They have, like, people who, like, hang out together and do videos together, have their own YouTube channels, and it's just basically, like, a way of people building up their YouTube career. So they, you know, they have a team, and then Jake Paul, like, he does videos with them, and a lot of them are just, like, very abusive, very, very bullying. And, you know, he's gotten a lot of flack over that.
Is he the guy that has, like, that, like, blonde hair? And
he's got blonde hair. His brother is Logan Paul, who did the video of the Japan. Suicide Forest.
Yeah. Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Okay, yes.
So, yeah, they're not
so they're both crazy.
Similar, but they are both, like, very hyperactive. They love doing stunts and all that. So, like, you know, they were doing a special and they were trying to figure out maybe he was a sociopath. So, but, like, I've been trying to analyze characters that I see in movies now based on what I've seen or what I've heard from those videos. Because, like, you know, sociopaths are supposed to have no emotion at all.
Right. No empathy at all.
Yeah. No happiness, no sadness, no anger. So it was like, seeing these characters and seeing how they react to these different situations, I felt like, what's his name again?
Jerry?
Peter Stormare's
character. Oh, yeah, he's definitely a sociopath for sure. Yeah.
But I was thinking, like, what would make him a psychopath? And I asked my girlfriend that because she has a bachelor's in psychology. She was like, well, psychopaths are, like, more impulsive and they don't, they really just don't think about, you know, the consequences.
Sounds legit.
So, yeah. So, I think Peter Stormare's character might have been a psychopath. More a psychopath than a sociopath. Because, you know, he... When the cop is about to pull Steve Buscemi out of the car, you know, he grabs the cop's head and then grabs the gun, shoots him right in the head.
Right.
And, you know, it's a pretty crazy scene for what we, you know, what we've seen so far in the movie.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you know, he axes Steve Buscemi to death and chops him up and puts him in a wood chipper.
Yeah.
So,
you know, and largely because he didn't want to split the car.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't want to split the car. He didn't want to split the money. He wanted everything to himself. And also because Steve Buscemi just pissed him off at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, he's like, oh, God damn it. Yeah.
But then again, if he's a psychopath or a sociopath, did he really piss him off? I don't think he really pissed him off. I think something just happened that would have put him in a situation where he would have to struggle.
Yeah.
That's why he did that.
Yeah, because he knew. Because he's like, oh, you know what? This is not fair. Okay, whatever. I'm just going to take care of this now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, yeah, yeah. I mean, you're right. Completely right. I do think that Jerry is a sociopath, though.
You think so?
Jerry.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, when he was you know, thinking about calling his father-in-law, what's his name? His father-in-law's name is Wade. Mm-hmm. When he was thinking about calling Wade, you know, he was pretending to cry or to be scared. But the entire time, like, he was just either, you know, figuring out what he was trying to do. That's probably what, you know, tripped him up, is, you know, thinking about what he was trying to do. But yeah, he really didn't have any emotion for his wife.
Yeah, especially when he kind of figures out the deal where, oh man, maybe I can get this parking lot thing going. Mm-hmm. And he goes to Shep and he's like, hey, I need to call your friend. He's like, you know, well, I can't vouch for the other guy. He's like, he doesn't care. He's like, he doesn't realize how much deep shit his wife's at.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right. Snaps his fingers. Like, I'll see you later. And I'm like, dude, like, what the hell? Like, I would have been like, well, first of all, I would have never done that to my wife.
Yeah.
Like, I think the moment that you get to the point where you even have a thought of, well, I'll do a ransom money, it's like, I need to change my life.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're thinking about putting someone's life in danger, or your own life in danger, it's not a very good idea.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So he's clearly, in my opinion, a sociopath, for sure. Which goes into show, like, the psychopaths and the sociopaths, people, whatever. The sociopaths and psychopaths are people that kind of in the fringes. They live in the fringes.
Well, actually, in that video of Shane Dawson, they mentioned that 1 in 25 people or 24 people.
What? That's scary. That's scary.
Yeah. 1 in 24, 25 people just can't feel any emotions.
That's insane, man. Yeah. Like, I feel bad when I say something. Like, I remember, like, at work I was talking to somebody and I didn't say anything bad, but then I just felt like, oh my gosh, did I offend them because I said something? I said some joke and I was like, did I offend them? Like, oh my God. Like, I overthink a lot of these things. I'm like, oh, she's going to hate me. And then I apologize. And then it's even more awkward because they're like, no, no. Like, you know, they offended me. So it's like, I can't imagine. Well, I guess I can, because I kind of feel like if you're going to be a politician,
yeah,
you have to be some sort of sociopath.
I honestly believe a lot of politicians are sociopaths. You know, like, they understand that politics gives you a lot of money. A lot of opportunity to gain a lot of money.
And power.
Yeah.
So, yeah. If anybody's like, well, you know, I'll give you some of my money, but... I mean, because it's like a whole different type of ball game up there, man.
Yeah.
Like, you know, now you're passing laws not necessarily to protect the citizens, but, you know, to help some business guy that got you votes at some state, you know.
Yeah.
It's just crazy, crazy stuff. But yeah, you know, sociopathic people, what can you do? Now going back to Fargo,
mm-hmm.
See, that's a testament of a good classic movie right there, man. It just gets you thinking.
Yeah.
We'll get down to the end here, which kind of gives you a really nice resolve, and for me gave me really good perspective this time around. When I was younger, I never really understood it, but it ends in a really good note.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before I get to that, I thought this was interesting. The opening shot is just like a white shot, and it's like this car coming in, and it has another car being towed, which is Jerry taking the car to the guys. It's like the beginning of this kidnapping scheme. And they have almost the same exact shot at the end, but it's ambulances. And it's like the aftermath of this scheme. So I thought that was brilliant. It's the exact same shot, but like framed the same. Oh my gosh, that's just the genius of them. And the Paul Bunyan in the beginning and the end. Oh man, the symmetry, I guess, you know, it's just genius. But that could have just ended there. But they decided, no, you know, there's this other kind of underlying story in regards to the husband, artist. Mm-hmm. And I thought there is intention with that. It's not kind of like an epilogue. Mm-hmm. At first, I thought it was an epilogue, but I think there's a whole thing with that they're trying to say.
Yeah.
In regards to chaos and order, but if you think about an artist, you know, going back, Margie and her husband have a process. And I think what it is they understand themselves very well.
Yeah.
And they understand what they love out of life. Like, she's already talking about what a beautiful day it is.
Yeah.
And even though it's cold and all that shit, whatever. He's talking to a fucking convict.
Yeah.
And she's, like, worried about, like, wow, man, why are these people doing this? But then she's like, you know what? But look, it's like a beautiful day. Like, there's so much you can do. And what I started thinking is, you have two things going on. You have a duality in that car.
Yeah.
You have someone that's just death, and then she's bringing life into this new world. You know. And so you have the difference there, and I think that's what they're trying to say. Which leads me to something else. Remind me. I'm trying not to go on tangent, but so you have this duality of death and life, and it ends with life.
Yeah.
Because they're sitting there, and in my opinion, what life's about, it's about creating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about, and that's the thing, when we're young, I think about it as if we're a bunch of little cubs that were just like kind of like fighting against each other, you know, like little dogs when they're together, they're trying to learn how to walk and stuff, and then they're fighting with their brothers.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like that's what we're at right now as human beings. We're just like kind of just fighting and figuring it out. But then there comes a time where that becomes boring and you start realizing, well, there's more to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand is that I think that's why a lot of people turn into hobbies like gardening. They want to see things grow, or they grow families because they're seeing life grow and they're creating something. This guy's an artist. He's creating something.
Mm-hmm.
And she realizes the beauty in that.
Yeah.
She's not harping on him like, I need more money, or I need a man. She's like, she understands that this guy creates beautiful things and he loves doing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of find a process, you know?
So, okay, go ahead and finish your point.
So my last thing I want to say is that they end up with him just saying 2 months. And they're referring to the baby.
Mm.
And there you go. That's the statement. Like, people, stop worrying about how to live your life according to how this fucking box tells you to do it.
Yeah.
And see the real thing about life. The real things that's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really what they're trying to say on top of this linear thing.
Mm.
I mean, it's a movie that ages, in my opinion. Like, once you watch it, like, a few times, because it took me like 6 times. Well, I've seen it more than 10 times, probably.
Yeah.
Like,
I think I've seen it like 3 times. But yeah, I definitely, like, it's such a good movie. Like,
so many layers.
Yeah. I'm sorry, did I cut you off from
here? No.
So, like, when you brought up the whole thing about Margie and her husband, you know, being very comfortable where they're at, you know, her not trying to, you know, trying to take control and trying to tell him what she wants him to be, what she thinks her idea of a man is, you know, all that. That's a very good point, I believe. Because I've been seeing this one ad on YouTube. I forget what company created it, but it's this very, very far right conservative notion of what a man is, which they had good, very good points, but at the same time, they generalized. So, just, you know, this is for anyone, any guy who's confused about what he should be, how he should be. You know, you're you. You do whatever the fuck you want. You're going to find someone who accepts you for that. You will. It might take a while. It might not. But at least, you know, the thing about being someone's partner is to not compromise, but to have the will to make the other person happy and comfortable, you know? But, you know, this ad, it was talking about toxic masculinity, which I believe is a thing. Toxic masculinity is definitely the, you know, machismoism. We both live in that culture. Very toxic culture, you know, very homophobic, very aggressive. You know, the first thing they want you to do is to, you know, stand up for yourself, which, in other words, they want you to fight, which I think isn't the best idea for most situations. But so this ad was talking about toxic masculinity and how feminists have gotten him wrong, which again brings up a good point if they weren't generalizing, because not, you know, not every feminist is the same, not every feminist has the same ideals, you know, all these movements are spectrums, you know, different people want different things, and you would see that when do you remember the Occupy Wall Street movement? Yeah, like with the movement like that, you know, people wanted different things. Well, they were talking about how, you know, today's society really shuns competition and, you know, just winning, which I think sometimes it happens. Not a lot of times. Like, there's still a lot of competitive things. We still have sports in schools, for crying out loud. So it's not like competition is viewed as something bad. But, you know, there are certain things. It's probably not... I'm not sure how many schools even have it, you know, where every kid wins a trophy now. Like, I don't know how many schools. I don't know those statistics. And again, I think they're just generalizing. So they're talking about that, and they're talking about how in men's nature, you know, we're supposed to be more aggressive, more competitive, and all this. And I think that's complete bullshit, because that honestly to me just sounds like a personality trait. And anyone is capable of picking up those personality traits. So, you know, there was that I had a problem with. And then the fact that they were just, you know, bashing on feminist movements, which I think is a stupid generalization. Because like I said, you know, not all feminists are the same. And I mean, I don't personally think I'm a feminist anymore. Mostly because of, like, just the generalizations, you know? Just people trying to define what I believe just because of this title that we've been given to our sets of beliefs.
Yeah, no, I believe the same thing. This is something I talk to a lot of family members about. If you, even just saying if you're a Republican or Democrat, pigeonholes you.
Dude, so bad. Oh my god, yes. It's so terrible. It is so terrible.
So for me, like, I get the idea of anybody being oppressed. Like, okay, I get it. Like, we don't want anybody to be oppressed.
Yeah.
But there's a line, like, you know, you can't just point fingers at each other, and that's really what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I think this is a good testament about, you know, movies like this, is that when you point the finger at somebody, you're pointing the finger, but you're not realizing the things that you could be fixing for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, because everybody's so different.
Yeah.
Like, my relationship is so different than my brother's relationship. You know, we all have different characteristics and personalities, and what works for me may not work for you.
Yeah.
It just depends on the lifestyle that you want to go for. I mean, I know we're friends with couples that they do everything together.
Yeah.
And they're happy. And they're not, you know, they don't criticize anybody and they do their own thing. But for us, if we were together 24/7, I think these couples like work together and they have their own roles.
Yeah.
Like they choose to do what they want to do. And they don't have somebody like, the man's not like, you got to cook for me or whatever. Like, you know, the woman decides to do that and they cook for the man and that just happens to be what works for them and what makes them happy. For us, it doesn't work that way. I cook most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more of an artist and she just loves to work.
Yeah.
I mean, I work too, but you know, when it comes to cleaning, she's better at cleaning certain things and I'm better at not doing certain things. Okay.
Yeah.
So it works different for everybody. And I think that's the problem is that we need to just step back.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to look into ourselves, look in the mirror sort of thing and be like, hey man, you got to figure out what works for you.
Yeah. I think, I honestly think the biggest problem is that people don't know what the fuck they want.
Yeah, exactly. And they, and the problem, and that's the main problem. That's how cults get started.
Yeah.
Because somebody will take those guys and brainwash them and tell them, well, you got to do this. And this is,
yeah.
That's a major reason.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm very passionate about people that get roped into all these different little holes that the world has.
Mm-hmm.
These brainwashing holes, like, oh my gosh, you can't get started with that. But, you know, going back to television brainwashes you to buy things you don't need, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's all types of different societies and clubs that pigeonhole you into living a certain life.
Mm-hmm.
And think about this. I'm a Spurs fan, but I watched a video on how Greg Popovich is a cult leader. And at first I was like, this is stupid. But then you start like seeing all the stuff that he does, the way he runs his organization, and you're like,
yeah.
Oh damn, like fuck, like this could be a reality, you know? Like,
yeah.
So you all gotta, in a way, in a small little example, of course these people would fall in line because what they want in the end of the day is they want to win a trophy.
Yeah.
They want to win the finals and they think this man can take us there and they'll do anything. They're submissive to his power.
Yeah.
So you could see it happen. It just depends on what it is that you worship. And like in Fargo, the two henchmen, they're worshiping money.
Yeah.
And so that's why they fall into these fucking crazy schemes.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, you know, you have Margie who understands that, you know, money is a tool.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people do this? Like, you just do this just for some money? Like, because I think she sees, like, the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Her and her husband. And I remember her husband gets commissioned for a 3-cent stamp. And he's all like, oh, man, I won't, you know. Well, so-and-so got the 29 cent. She's like, oh, yeah, but, you know, stamps are going to increase. And
mm-hmm.
people are going to need that.
Yep.
2-cent stamp, which is so fucking true.
Yeah.
When the 37th stamp came out, we're like, fuck. We meet old man ways who still writes letters. But it's so true. Like, she's so happy at his achievements. And
yeah.
Going back to partnership is that instead of pointing fingers and falling in line into all these different whack out things, in the end of the day, you should just, you know, try to be a good person to your significant other. Like, mm-hmm. that's as simple as it can be.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because, like, another part of the ad that like, upset me because it's just like I said, the ad is just generalizing a lot of people. Like,
and that's what most of these things do. Yeah. They generalize.
And it's like, they're talking about, you know, what type of man that women want. And it's like, well, you don't know. Why is this ad speaking for all women? Because it's like, it's talking about how like, and any woman I know doesn't want a man who can't provide for her. And it's like, well, first off, that's bullshit because there's different ways of providing for someone.
Correct.
You know, there's the, you know, the emotional, you know, providing emotional support, providing, you know, I mean, there is the financial thing. That's
yep.
that could be a very big factor in most people's
But then they're crying that women don't get paid enough. It's like it's a whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, the one thing that stood out to me was the whole providing for someone. Because it's like I said, you know, you can provide in different ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could be a stay-at-home dad. You can, you know, just be a maid pretty much. You know, just stay at home, clean up everything. And that helps a lot of people out because... Right. Yeah.
Well, like, yeah, it goes back to just depends on, and that's the thing, it's always going to change because, like, right now, both my wife and I are going to school, so we just try to help each other the best we can.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a time where, like, she's going to be done with school, I'm going to be done with school, and she's going to be like, well, I want to travel. That's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
I was just talking to the guy who detailed my car, you know, talking about how he left his job to do his own business because his wife was like, you're never home.
Mm-hmm.
You're never home. He made good amount of money, but he was never home. Her needs might be different than somebody else's.
Yeah.
Like, come on, people. Get a grip. Like, there's so many different ways, and that's the thing is the mind is so complex.
Mm-hmm.
You can't generalize things because for one person, it might not matter.
Yeah.
So, for me, I think we all kind of go through this. I went through my own stuff, like, oh, things aren't fair, blah blah blah. But then you start thinking about it, man. It's like, you know what, I need to just focus on me. And I think if, you know, my brother told me the same thing, he's like, you know, if more people focus on their own lives, I think the world would be a little bit better.
Is that your little brother told you that?
No, that guy's crazy. That guy's insane. That guy worships money. That's a whole other ball game. But that's why we watch these movies, because at least the good ones kind of start getting you to think about your life. And I kind of feel like that was a statement, in my opinion, that the Coen brothers were trying to make. Like, you know, watch, this life's crazy, man, but just don't overcomplicate things. You can make things simple. Just do things that you love to do. For me, I love classic movies. I would love to someday just write something and start making little videos or something, you know, like, that's, to me, this is an education and how the masters do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about these movies